Chapter 6. The Journey from Platform 9 3/4. Harry's last month with the Dursleys wasn't fun. True, Dudley was now so scared of Harry he wouldn't stay in the same room, while Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon didn't shut Harry in his cupboard, force him to do anything or shout at him. In fact, they didn't speak to him at all. Half terrified, half furious, they acted as though any chair with Harry in it was empty. Although this was an improvement in many ways, it did become a bit depressing after a while. Harry kept to his room, with his new owl for company. He had decided to call her Hedwig, a name he had found in A History of Magic. His schoolbooks were very interesting. He lay on his bed, reading late into the night, Hedwig swooping in and out of the open window as she pleased. It was lucky that Aunt Petunia didn't come in to Hoover any more, because Hedwig kept bringing back dead mice. Every night before he went to sleep, Harry ticked off another day on the piece of paper he had pinned to the wall, counting down to September 1st. On the last day of August, he thought he'd better speak to his aunt and uncle about getting to King's Cross Station next day. So he went down to the living room where they were watching a quiz show on television. He cleared his throat to let them know he was there, and Dudley screamed and ran from the room. Uncle Vernon? Uncle Vernon grunted to show he was listening. I need to be at King's Cross tomorrow to go to Hogwarts. Uncle Vernon grunted again. Would it be all right if you gave me a lift? Grunt. Harry supposed that meant yes. Thank you. He was about to go back upstairs when Uncle Vernon actually spoke.
Funny way to get to a wizard school, the train. Magic carpets all got punctures, have they?
Harry didn't say anything.
Where is this school, anyway?
I don't know, said Harry, realizing this for the first time. He pulled the ticket Hagrid had given him out of his pocket. I just take the train from platform 9 3/4 at 11 o'clock, he read. His aunt and uncle stared.
Platform what?
9 3/4.
Don't talk rubbish, said Uncle Vernon. There is no platform 9 3/4.
It's on my ticket.
Barking, said Uncle Vernon. Howling mad, the lot of them. You'll see. You just wait. All right, we'll take you to King's Cross. We're going up to London tomorrow anyway, or I wouldn't bother.
"Why are you going to London?" Harry asked, trying to keep things friendly.
"Taking Dudley to hospital," growled Uncle Vernon. "Got to have that ruddy tail removed before he goes to smeltings."
Harry woke at 5 o'clock the next morning and was too excited and nervous to go back to sleep. He got up and pulled on his jeans, because he didn't want to walk into the station in his wizard's robes. He'd change on the train. He checked his Hogwarts list yet again to make sure he had everything he needed, saw that Hedwig was shut safely in her cage, and then paced the room, waiting for the Dursleys to get up. 2 hours later, Harry's huge, heavy trunk had been loaded into the Dursleys' car, Aunt Petunia had talked Dudley into sitting next to Harry, and they had set off. They reached King's Cross at 10:30. Uncle Vernon dumped Harry's trunk onto a trolley and wheeled it onto the station for him. Harry thought this was strangely kind, until Uncle Vernon stopped dead, facing the platforms with a nasty grin on his face.
"Well, there you are, boy. Platform 9, platform 10. Your platform should be somewhere in the middle, but they don't seem to have built it yet, do they?"
He was quite right, of course. There was a big plastic number 9 over one platform, and a big plastic number 10 over the one next to it. And in the middle, nothing at all.
"Have a good term," said Uncle Vernon with an even nastier smile. He left without another word.
Harry turned and saw the Dursleys drive away. All three of them were laughing. Harry's mouth went rather dry. What on earth was he going to do? He was starting to attract a lot of funny looks because of Hedwig. He'd have to ask someone. He stopped a passing guard, but didn't dare mention platform 9 3/4. The guard had never heard of Hogwarts, and when Harry couldn't even tell him what part of the country it was in, he started to get annoyed, as though Harry was being stupid on purpose. Getting desperate, Harry asked for the train that left at 11 o'clock, but the guard said there wasn't one. In the end, the guard strode away, muttering about time-wasters. Harry was now trying hard not to panic. According to the large clock over the arrivals board, he had 10 minutes left to get on the train to Hogwarts, and he had no idea how to do it. He was stranded in the middle of a station with a trunk he could hardly lift, a pocket full of wizard money, and a large owl. Hagrid must have forgotten to tell him something you had to do, like tapping the third brick on the left to get into Diagon Alley. He wondered if he should get out his wand and start tapping the ticket box between platforms 9 and 10. At that moment, a group of people passed just behind him, and he caught a few words of what they were saying. Packed with muggles, of course. Harry swung round. The speaker was a plump woman who was talking to 4 boys, all with flaming red hair. Each of them was pushing a trunk like Harry's in front of him, and they had an owl. Heart hammering, Harry pushed his trolley after them. They stopped, and so did he, just near enough to hear what they were saying. "Now, what's the platform number?" said the boy's mother.
9 3/4,
piped a small girl, also red-headed, who was holding her hand.
"Mum, can't I go?"
"You're not old enough, Ginny. Now be quiet. All right, Percy, you go first."
What looked like the oldest boy marched towards platforms 9 and 10. Harry watched, careful not to blink in case he missed it. But just as the boy reached the divide between the 2 platforms, a large crowd of tourists came swarming in front of him, and by the time the last rucksack had cleared away, the boy had vanished.
"Fred, you next," the plump woman said.
"I'm not Fred, I'm George," said the boy. "Honestly, woman, call yourself our mother. Can't you tell I'm George?"
"Sorry, George, dear."
"Only joking. I am Fred,"
said the boy, and off he went. His twin called after him to hurry up, and he must have done, because a second later he had gone. But how had he done it? Now the third brother was walking briskly towards the ticket barrier. He was almost there, and then, quite suddenly, he wasn't anywhere. There was nothing else for it.
"Excuse me," Harry said to the plump woman. "Hello, dear," she said. "First time at Hogwarts. Ron's new, too."
She pointed at the last and youngest of her sons. He was tall, thin and gangling, with freckles, big hands and feet, and a long nose.
"Yes," said Harry. "The thing is, I don't know how to get onto the platform,"
she said kindly, and Harry nodded.
"Not to worry," she said. "All you have to do is walk straight at the barrier between platforms 9 and 10. Don't stop, and don't be scared you'll crash into it. That's very important. Best do it at a bit of a run if you're nervous. Go on. Go now, before Ron."
"Okay,"
said Harry. He pushed his trolley round and stared at the barrier. It looked very solid. He started to walk towards it. People jostled him on their way to platforms 9 and 10. Harry walked more quickly. He was going to smash right into that ticket box, and then he'd be in trouble. Leaning forward on his trolley, he broke into a heavy run. The barrier was coming nearer and nearer. He wouldn't be able to stop. The trolley was out of control. He was a foot away. He closed his eyes, ready for the crash. It didn't come. He kept on running. He opened his eyes. A scarlet steam engine was waiting next to a platform packed with people. A sign overhead said, "Hogwarts Express, 11 o'clock. Harry looked behind him and saw a wrought iron archway where the ticket box had been, with the words, "Platform 9 3/4" on it. He had done it. Smoke from the engine drifted over the heads of the chattering crowd, while cats of every colour wound here and there between their legs. Owls hooted to each other in a disgruntled sort of way over the babble and the scraping of heavy trunks. The first few carriages were already packed with students, some hanging out of the window to talk to their families, some fighting over seats. Harry pushed his trolley off down the platform in search of an empty seat. He passed a round-faced boy who was saying,
"Gran, I've lost my toad again."
"Oh, Neville!" he heard the old woman sigh.
A boy with dreadlocks was surrounded by a small crowd.
"Give us a look, Lee. Go on."
The boy lifted the lid of a box in his arms, and the people around him shrieked and yelled as something inside poked out a long, hairy leg. Harry pressed on through the crowd until he found an empty compartment near the end of the train. He put Hedwig inside first, and then started to shove and heave his trunk towards the train door. He tried to lift it up the steps, but could hardly raise one end, and twice he dropped it painfully on his foot.
"Want a hand?"
It was one of the red-haired twins he had followed through the ticket box.
"Yes, please,"
Harry panted.
"Oi, Fred, come here and help!"
With the twins' help, Harry's trunk was at last tucked away in a corner of the compartment.
"Thanks,"
said Harry, pushing his sweaty hair out of his eyes.
"What's that?"
said one of the twins suddenly, pointing at Harry's lightning scar.
"Blimey,"
said the other twin.
"Are you—"
"He is," said the first twin.
"Aren't you?"
he added to Harry.
"What?"
said Harry.
"Harry Potter,"
chorused the twins.
"Oh, him," said Harry. "I mean, yes, I am."
The two boys gawped at him, and Harry felt himself going red. Then, to his relief, a voice came floating in through the train's open door.
"Fred? George? Are you there?"
"Coming, Mum."
With a last look at Harry, the twins hopped off the train. Harry sat down next to the window, where, half hidden, he could watch the red-haired family on the platform and hear what they were saying. Their mother had just taken out her handkerchief.
"Ron, you've got something on your nose."
The youngest boy tried to jerk out of the way, but she grabbed him and began rubbing the end of his nose.
"Mum, get off!"
he wriggled free.
"Ah, has Ickle Ronnie got something on his nosey?"
said one of the twins.
"Shut up!"
said Ron.
"Where's Percy?"
said their mother. "He's coming now." The oldest boy came striding into sight. He had already changed into his billowing black Hogwarts robes, and Harry noticed a shiny silver badge on his chest with the letter P on it.
"Can't stay long, Mother," he said. "I'm up front. The prefects have got two compartments to themselves."
"Oh, are you a prefect, Percy?" said one of the twins with an air of great surprise.
"You should have said something. We had no idea."
"Hang on, I think I remember him saying something about it," said the other twin.
"Once
or twice.
A minute.
All summer."
"Oh, shut up," said Percy, the prefect.
"How come Percy gets new robes anyway?"
said one of the twins.
"Because he's a prefect,"
said their mother fondly.
"All right, dear. Well, have a good term. Send me an owl when you get there."
She kissed Percy on the cheek, and he left. Then she turned to the twins.
"Now, you two, this year you behave yourselves. If I get one more owl telling me you've blown up a toilet, or—"
"Blown up a toilet? We've never blown up a toilet."
"Great idea, though.
Thanks, Mum."
"It's not funny.
And look after Ron."
"Don't worry, Ickle Runnikins is safe with us."
"Shut up,"
said Ron again. He was almost as tall as the twins already, and his nose was still pink where his mother had rubbed it.
"Hey, Mum, guess what? Guess who we just met on the train?"
Harry leant back quickly, so they couldn't see him looking.
"You know that black-haired boy who was near us in the station?"
"Know who he is?"
"Who?"
"Harry Potter."
Harry heard the little girl's voice.
"Oh, Mum, can I go on the train and see him, Mum?
Oh, please!"
"You've already seen him, Ginny, and the poor boy isn't something you goggle at in a zoo."
"Is he really, Fred?
How do you know?"
"Asked him. Saw his scar. It's really there, like lightning."
"Poor dear. No wonder he was alone. I wondered. He was ever so polite when he asked how to get onto the platform."
"Never mind that. Do you think he remembers what
you know who looks like?"
Their mother suddenly became very stern.
"I forbid you to ask him, Fred. No, don't you dare. As though he needs reminding of that on his first day at school."
"All right, keep your hair on."
A whistle sounded.
"Hurry up,"
their mother said, and the three boys clambered onto the train. They leant out of the window for her to kiss them goodbye, and their younger sister began to cry.
don't, Ginny. We'll send you loads of owls. We'll send you a Hogwarts toilet seat. George! Only joking, Mum.
The train began to move. Harry saw the boy's mother waving and their sister, half laughing, half crying, running to keep up with the train until it gathered too much speed. Then she fell back and waved. Harry watched the girl and her mother disappear as the train rounded the corner. Houses flashed past the window. Harry felt a great leap of excitement. He didn't know what he was going to, but it had to be better than what he was leaving behind. The door of the compartment slid open, and the youngest red-headed boy came in.
"Anyone sitting there?" he asked, pointing at the seat opposite Harry.
"Everywhere else is full."
Harry shook his head, and the boy sat down.
He glanced at Harry and then looked quickly out of the window, pretending he hadn't looked. Harry saw he still had a black mark on his nose.
"Hey, Ron!"
The twins were back.
"Listen, we're going down the middle of the train. Lee Jordan's got a giant tarantula down there."
"Right,"
mumbled Ron.
"Harry," said the other twin, "did we introduce ourselves? Fred and George Weasley, and this is Ron, our brother. See you later, then."
"Bye,"
said Harry and Ron. The twins slid the compartment door shut behind them.
"Are you really Harry Potter?"
Ron blurted out. Harry nodded.
"Oh,
well, I thought it might be one of Fred and George's jokes," said Ron. "And have you really got, you know?"
He pointed at Harry's forehead. Harry pulled back his fringe to show the lightning scar. Ron stared.
"So that's where you know who?"
"Yes," said Harry, "but I can't remember it."
"Nothing?"
said Ron eagerly.
"Well, I remember a lot of green light, but nothing else."
"Wow,"
said Ron. He sat and stared at Harry for a few moments. Then, as though he had suddenly realized what he was doing, he looked quickly out of the window again.
"Are all your family wizards?"
asked Harry, who found Ron just as interesting as Ron found him.
Yes, I think so,"
said Ron. "I think Mum's got a second cousin who's an accountant, but we never talk about him."
"So you must know loads of magic already."
The Weasleys were clearly one of those old wizarding families the pale boy in Diagon Alley had talked about.
"I heard you went to live with Muggles,"
said Ron.
"What are they like?"
"Horrible. Well, not all of them. My aunt and uncle and cousin are, though. Wish I'd had three wizard brothers."
"Five," said Ron.
For some reason he was looking gloomy.
"I'm the sixth in our family to go to Hogwarts.
You could say I've got a lot to live up to. Bill and Charlie have already left. Bill was head boy, and Charlie was captain of Quidditch. Now Percy's a prefect. Fred and George mess around a lot, but they still get really good marks, and everyone thinks they're really funny. Everyone expects me to do as well as the others, but if I do, it's no big deal, because they did it first. You never get anything new, either, with five brothers. I've got Bill's old robes, Charlie's old wand, and Percy's old rat." Ron reached inside his jacket and pulled out a fat, grey rat, which was asleep. "His name's Scabbers, and he's useless. He hardly ever wakes up. Percy got an owl from my dad for being made a prefect. But they couldn't have... I mean, I got Scabbers instead." Ron's ears went pink. He seemed to think he'd said too much, because he went back to staring out of the window. Harry didn't think there was anything wrong with not being able to afford an owl. After all, he'd never had any money in his life until a month ago, and he told Ron so, all about having to wear Dudley's old clothes and never getting proper birthday presents. This seemed to cheer Ron up. "And until Hagrid told me, I didn't know anything about being a wizard or about my parents or Voldemort." Ron gasped.
"What?"
said Harry.
"You said you know whose name," said Ron, sounding both shocked and impressed. "I'd have thought you, of all people." "I'm not trying to be brave or anything, saying the name," said Harry. "I just never knew you shouldn't. See what I mean? I've got loads to learn. I bet," he added, voicing for the first time something that had been worrying him a lot lately, "I bet I'm the worst in the class."
"You won't be. There's loads of people who come from Muggle families, and they learn quick enough."
While they had been talking, the train had carried them out of London. Now they were speeding past fields full of cows and sheep. They were quiet for a time, watching the fields and lanes flick past. Around 12:30, there was a great clattering outside in the corridor, and a smiling, dimpled woman slid back their door and said,
"Anything off the trolley, dears?"
Harry, who hadn't had any breakfast, leapt to his feet, but Ron's ears went pink again, and he muttered that he'd brought sandwiches. Harry went out into the corridor. He had never had any money for sweets with the Dursleys, and now that he had pockets rattling with gold and silver, he was ready to buy as many Mars bars as he could carry. But the woman didn't have Mars bars. What she did have were Bertie Bott's Every Flavour Beans, Drubal's Best Blowing Gum, chocolate frogs, pumpkin pasties, cauldron cakes, licorice wands, and a number of other strange things Harry had never seen in his life. Not wanting to miss anything, he got some of everything, and paid the woman 11 silver sickles and 7 bronze knuts. Ron stared as Harry brought it all back into the compartment and tipped it onto an empty seat.
"Hungry, are you?"
"Starving," said Harry, taking a large bite out of a pumpkin pasty. Ron had taken out a lumpy package and unwrapped it. There were 4 sandwiches in there. He pulled one of them apart and said,
"She always forgets I don't like corned beef."
"Swap you for one of these," said Harry, holding up a pasty. "Go on."
"You don't want this, it's all dry," said Ron.
"She hasn't got much time," he added quickly, "you know, with 5 of us."
"Go on, have a pasty," said Harry, who had never had anything to share before, or indeed any one to share it with.
It was a nice feeling, sitting there with Ron, eating their way through all Harry's pasties and cakes. The sandwiches lay forgotten.
"What are these?" Harry asked Ron, holding up a pack of chocolate frogs. "They're not really frogs, are they?"
He was starting to feel that nothing would surprise him.
"No," said Ron, "but see what the card is. I'm missing a gripper."
"What?"
"Oh, of course, you wouldn't know. Chocolate frogs have cards inside them, you know, to collect. Famous witches and wizards. I've got about 500, but I haven't got a gripper or Ptolemy."
Harry unwrapped his chocolate frog and picked up the card. It showed a man's face. He wore half-moon glasses, had a long, crooked nose and flowing silver hair, beard and moustache. Underneath the picture was the name Albus Dumbledore.
"So this is Dumbledore," said Harry.
"Don't tell me you've never heard of Dumbledore," said Ron.
"Can I have a frog? I might get a gripper. Thanks."
Harry turned over his card and read, "Albus Dumbledore, currently headmaster of Hogwarts. Considered by many the greatest wizard of modern times, Dumbledore is particularly famous for his defeat of the dark wizard Grindelwald in 1945, for the discovery of the 12 uses of dragon's blood, and his work on alchemy with his partner, Nicholas Flamel. Professor Dumbledore enjoys chamber music and 10-pin bowling." Harry turned the card back over and saw, to his astonishment, that Dumbledore's face had disappeared.
"He's gone."
"Well, you can't expect him to hang around all day," said Ron.
"He'll be back."
"No, I've got Morgana again. I've got about 6 of her. Do you want it? You can start collecting."
Ron's eyes strayed to the pile of chocolate frogs waiting to be unwrapped.
"Help yourself," said Harry. "But in, you know, the muggle world, people just stay put in photos."
"Do they? What, they don't move at all?"
Ron sounded amazed.
"Weird!"
Harry stared as Dumbledore sidled back into the picture on his card and gave him a small smile. Ron was more interested in eating the frogs than looking at the famous witches and wizards cards, but Harry couldn't keep his eyes off them. Soon he had not only Dumbledore and Morgana, but Hengist of Woodcroft, Alberic Grunion, Circe, Paracelsus, and Merlin. He finally tore his eyes away from the druidess Cleodna, who was scratching her nose, to open a bag of Bertie Bott's Every Flavour Beans.
"You want to be careful with those," Ron warned Harry. "When they say every flavour, they mean every flavour. You know, you get all the ordinary ones, like chocolate and peppermint and marmalade, but then you can get spinach and liver and tripe. George reckons he had a bogey-flavoured one once."
Ron picked up a green bean, looked at it carefully, and bit into a corner.
"See? Sprouts!"
They had a good time eating the every-flavour beans.
Harry got toast, coconut, baked bean, strawberry, curry, grass, coffee, sardine, and was even brave enough to nibble the end off a funny grey one Ron wouldn't touch, which turned out to be pepper. The countryside, now flying past the window, was becoming wilder. The neat fields had gone. Now there were woods, twisting rivers, and dark green hills. There was a knock on the door of their compartment, and the round-faced boy Harry had passed on platform 9 3/4 came in. He looked tearful.
"Sorry," he said, "but have you seen a toad at all?"
When they shook their heads, he wailed.
"I've lost him. He keeps getting away from me."
"He'll turn up," said Harry.
"Yes," said the boy miserably. "Well, if you see him..."
He left.
"Don't know why he's so bothered," said Ron. "If I'd brought a toad, I'd lose it as quick as I could. Mind you, I brought Scabbers, so I can't talk."
The rat was still snoozing on Ron's lap.
"He might have died and you wouldn't know the difference," said Ron in disgust. "I tried to turn him yellow yesterday to make him more interesting, but the spell didn't work. I'll show you, look."
He rummaged around in his trunk and pulled out a very battered-looking wand. It was chipped in places, and something white was glinting at the end. Unicorn hairs nearly poking out. Anyway, he had just raised his wand when the compartment door slid open again. The toadless boy was back, but this time he had a girl with him. She was already wearing her new Hogwarts robes.
"Has anyone seen a toad? Neville's lost one," she said. She had a bossy sort of voice, lots of bushy brown hair, and rather large front teeth.
"We've already told him we haven't seen it," said Ron, but the girl wasn't listening. She was looking at the wand in his hand.
"Oh, are you doing magic? Let's see it, then."
She sat down. Ron looked taken aback.
All right."
He cleared his throat.
"Sunshine, daisies, butter mellow, turn this stupid fat rat yellow."
He waved his wand, but nothing happened. Scabbers stayed grey and fast asleep.
"Are you sure that's a real spell?" said the girl. "Well, it's not very good, is it? I've tried a few simple spells just for practice, and it's all worked for me. Nobody in my family's magic at all. It was ever such a surprise when I got my letter, but I was ever so pleased, of course. I mean, it's the very best school of witchcraft there is, I've heard. I've learned all our set books off by heart, of course. I just hope it'll be enough. I'm Hermione Granger, by the way. Who are you?"
She said all this very fast. Harry looked at Ron and was relieved to see by his stunned face that he hadn't learnt all the set books off by heart either.
"I'm Ron Weasley," Ron muttered.
"Harry Potter," said Harry.
"I really," said Hermione. "I know all about you, of course. I got a few extra books for background reading, and you're in Modern Magical History and The Rise and Fall of the Dark Arts and Great Wizarding Events of the 20th Century."
"Am I?" said Harry, feeling dazed.
"Goodness, didn't you know? I'd have found out everything I could if it was me," said Hermione. "Do either of you know what house you'll be in? I've been asking around, and I hope I'm in Gryffindor. It sounds by far the best. I hear Dumbledore himself was one, but I suppose Ravenclaw wouldn't be too bad. Anyway, we'd better go and look for Neville's toad. You two had better change, you know. I expect we'll be there soon."
And she left, taking the toadless boy with her. "Whatever house I'm in, I hope she's not in it," said Ron. He threw his wand back into his trunk. "Stupid spell. George gave it to me. Betty knew it was a dud."
"What house are your brothers in?" asked Harry.
"Gryffindor," said Ron. Gloom seemed to be settling on him again. "Mum and Dad were in it too. I don't know what they'll say if I'm not. I don't suppose Ravenclaw would be too bad, but imagine if they put me in Slytherin."
"That's the house Volt... I mean, you know who was in."
"Yeah," said Ron. He flopped back into his seat, looking depressed.
"You know, I think the ends of Scabbers' whiskers are a bit lighter," said Harry, trying to take Ron's mind off houses. "So what do your oldest brothers do now they've left, anyway?"
Harry was wondering what a wizard did once he'd finished school.
"Charlie's in Romania studying dragons, and Bill's in Africa doing something for Gringotts," said Ron. "Did you hear about Gringotts? It's been all over the Daily Prophet, but I don't suppose you get that with the Muggles. Someone tried to rob a high-security vault."
Harry stared.
"Really? What happened to them?"
"Nothing. That's why it's such big news. They haven't been caught. My dad says it must have been a powerful dark wizard to get round Gringotts. But they don't think they took anything. That's what's odd. Of course, everyone gets scared when something like this happens, in case you know who's behind it."
Harry turned this news over in his mind. He was starting to get a prickle of fear every time you-know-who was mentioned. He supposed this was all part of entering the magical world, but it had been a lot more comfortable saying Voldemort without worrying. "What's your Quidditch team?" Ron asked.
"I don't know any," Harry confessed.
"What?" Ron looked dumbfounded. "Oh, you wait, it's the best game in the world!" And he was off, explaining all about the four balls and the positions of the seven players, describing famous games he'd been to with his brothers and the broomstick he'd like to get if he had the money. He was just taking Harry through the finer points of the game when the compartment door slid open yet again. But it wasn't Neville the Toadless Boy or Hermione Granger this time. Three boys entered, and Harry recognized the middle one at once. It was the pale boy from Madame Malkin's robe shop. He was looking at Harry with a lot more interest than he'd shown back in Diagon Alley.
"Is it true?" he said. "They're saying all down the train that Harry Potter's in this compartment, so it's you, is it?"
"Yes," said Harry. He was looking at the other boys. Both of them were thick-set and looked extremely mean. Standing either side of the pale boy, they looked like bodyguards.
"Oh, this is Crab and this is Goyle," said the pale boy carelessly, noticing where Harry was looking. "And my name's Malfoy, Draco Malfoy."
Ron gave a slight cough, which might have been hiding a snigger. Draco Malfoy looked at him.
"Think my name's funny, do you? No need to ask who you are. My father told me all the Weasleys have red hair, freckles, and more children than they can afford."
He turned back to Harry.
"You'll soon find out some wizarding families are much better than others, Potter. You don't want to go making friends with the wrong sort. I can help you there."
He held out his hand to shake Harry's, but Harry didn't take it.
"I think I can tell who the wrong sort are for myself, thanks," he said coolly.
Draco Malfoy didn't go red, but a pink tinge appeared in his pale cheeks.
"I'd be careful if I were you, Potter," he said slowly. "Unless you're a bit politer, you'll go the same way as your parents. They didn't know what was good for them either. You hang around with riff-raff like the Weasleys and that Hagrid, and it'll rub off on you."
Both Harry and Ron stood up. Ron's face was as red as his hair.
"Say that again," he said. "You're going to fight us, are you?"
Malfoy sneered. "Unless you get out now," said Harry, more bravely than he felt, because Crabbe and Goyle were a lot bigger than him or Ron.
"But we don't feel like leaving, do we, boys? We've eaten all our food, and you still seem to have some."
Goyle reached towards the chocolate frogs next to Ron. Ron leapt forward, but before he'd so much as touched Goyle, Goyle let out a horrible yell. Scabbers, the rat, was hanging off his finger. Sharp little teeth sunk deep into Goyle's knuckle. Crabbe and Malfoy backed away as Goyle swung Scabbers round and round, howling, and when Scabbers finally flew off and hit the window, all three of them disappeared at once. Perhaps they thought there were more rats lurking among the sweets, or perhaps they'd heard footsteps, because a second later Hermione Granger had come in.
"What has been going on?"
she said, looking at the sweets all over the floor and Ron picking up Scabbers by his tail.
"I think he's been knocked out," Ron said to Harry.
He looked closer at Scabbers.
"No.
Oh, I don't believe it. He's gone back to sleep."
And so he had.
"You've met Malfoy before?"
Harry explained about their meeting in Diagon Alley.
"I've heard of his family," said Ron darkly. "They were some of the first to come back to our side after
you-know-who disappeared. Said they'd been bewitched. My dad doesn't believe it. He says Malfoy's father didn't need an excuse to go over to the dark side." He turned to Hermione.
"Can we help you with something?" "You'd better hurry up and put your robes on. I've just been up the front to ask the driver, and he says we're nearly there. You haven't been fighting, have you? You'll be in trouble before we even get there."
"Scabbers has been fighting, not us," said Ron, scowling at her. "Would you mind leaving while we change?"
"All right, I only came in here because people outside are behaving very childishly, racing up and down the corridors," said Hermione in a sniffy voice. "And you've got dirt in your nose, by the way, did you know?"
Ron glared at her as she left.
Harry peered out of the window. It was getting dark. He could see mountains and forests under a deep purple sky.
The train did seem to be slowing down. He and Ron took off their jackets and pulled on their long black robes. Ron's were a bit short for him. You could see his trainers underneath them. A voice echoed through the train. "We will be reaching Hogwarts in 5 minutes' time. Please leave your luggage on the train. It will be taken to the school separately." Harry's stomach lurched with nerves, and Ron, he saw, looked pale under his freckles. They crammed their pockets with the last of the sweets and joined the crowd thronging the corridor. The train slowed right down and finally stopped. People pushed their way towards the door and out onto a tiny dark platform. Harry shivered in the cold night air. Then a lamp came bobbing over the heads of the students, and Harry heard a familiar voice.
First years over here. All right there, Harry.
Hagrid's big, hairy face beamed over the sea of heads. Come on, follow me. Any more first years? Mind your step now. First years, follow me. Slipping and stumbling, they followed Hagrid down what seemed to be a steep, narrow path. It was so dark either side of them that Harry thought there must be thick trees there. Nobody spoke much. Neville, the boy who kept losing his toad, sniffed once or twice.
"You'll get your first sight of Hogwarts in a sec," Hagrid called over his shoulder. "Just round this bend here."
There was a loud, "Oh!" The narrow path had opened suddenly onto the edge of a great black lake. Perched atop a high mountain on the other side, its windows sparkling in the starry sky, was a vast castle with many turrets and towers.
"No more than four to a boat!"
Hagrid called, pointing to a fleet of little boats sitting in the water by the shore. Harry and Ron were followed into their boat by Neville and Hermione.
"Everyone in!" shouted Hagrid, who had a boat to himself. "Right then! Forward!"
And the fleet of little boats moved off all at once, gliding across the lake, which was as smooth as glass. Everyone was silent, staring up at the great castle overhead. It towered over them as they sailed nearer and nearer to the cliff on which it stood.
"Heads down!"
yelled Hagrid as the first boats reached the cliff. They all bent their heads, and the little boats carried them through a curtain of ivy which hid a wide opening in the cliff face. They were carried along a dark tunnel which seemed to be taking them right underneath the castle until they reached a kind of underground harbour where they clambered out onto rocks and pebbles.
"Oi, you there, is this your toad?"
said Hagrid, who was checking the boats as people climbed out of them.
"Trevor!"
cried Neville blissfully, holding out his hands. Then they clambered up a passageway in the rock after Hagrid's lamp, coming out at last onto smooth, damp grass right in the shadow of the castle. They walked up a flight of stone steps and crowded around the huge oak front door.
"Everyone here? You there? Still got your toad?"
Hagrid raised a gigantic fist and knocked three times on the castle door. Chapter 7. The Sorting Hat. The door swung open at once. A tall, black-haired witch in emerald-green robes stood there. She had a very stern face, and Harry's first thought was that this was not someone to cross.
"The first years, Professor McGonagall," said Hagrid.
"Thank you, Hagrid. I will take them from here."
She pulled the door wide. The entrance hall was so big you could have fitted the whole of the Dursleys' house in it. The stone walls were lit with flaming torches, like the ones at Gringotts. The ceiling was too high to make out, and a magnificent marble staircase facing them led to the upper floors. They followed Professor McGonagall across the flagged stone floor. Harry could hear the drone of hundreds of voices from a doorway to the right. The rest of the school must already be here. But Professor McGonagall showed the first years into a small empty chamber off the hall. They crowded in, standing rather closer together than they would usually have done, peering about nervously.
"Welcome to Hogwarts," said Professor McGonagall. "The start of term banquet will begin shortly, but before you take your seats in the great hall, you will be sorted into your houses. The sorting is a very important ceremony, because while you are here, your house will be something like your family within Hogwarts. You will have classes with the rest of your house, sleep in your house dormitory, and spend free time in your house common room. The four houses are called Gryffindor, Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, and Slytherin. Each house has its own noble history, and each has produced outstanding witches and wizards. While you are at Hogwarts, your triumphs will earn your house points, while any rule-breaking will lose house points. At the end of the year, the house with the most points is awarded the House Cup. A great honour. I hope each of you will be a credit to whichever house becomes yours. The sorting ceremony will take place in a few minutes in front of the rest of the school. I suggest you all smarten yourselves up as much as you can while you are waiting. Her eyes lingered for a moment on Neville's cloak, which was fastened under his left ear, and on Ron's smudged nose. Harry nervously tried to flatten his hair. "I shall return when we are ready for you," said Professor McGonagall. "Please wait quietly." She left the chamber. Harry swallowed. "How exactly do they sort us into houses?" he asked Ron. "Some sort of test, I think. Fred said it hurts a lot, but I think he was joking." Harry's heart gave a horrible jolt. A test? In front of the whole school? But he didn't know any magic yet. What on earth would he have to do? He hadn't expected something like this the moment they arrived. He looked around anxiously and saw that everyone else looked terrified too. No one was talking much, except Hermione Granger, who was whispering very fast about all the spells she'd learnt and wondering which one she'd need. Harry tried hard not to listen to her. He had never been more nervous. Never. Not even when he'd had to take a school report home to the Dursleys, saying that he'd somehow turned his teacher's wig blue. He kept his eyes fixed on the door. Any second now, Professor McGonagall would come back and lead him to his doom. Then something happened which made him jump about a foot in the air. Several people behind him screamed. "What the?" He gasped. So did the people around him. About 20 ghosts had just streamed through the back wall. Pearly white and slightly transparent, they glided across the room, talking to each other and hardly glancing at the first years. They seemed to be arguing. What looked like a fat little monk was saying, "Forgive and forget, I say. We ought to give him a second chance." "My dear friar, haven't we given Peeves all the chances he deserves? He gives us all a bad name, and, you know, he's not really even a ghost." "I say, what are you all doing here?" A ghost wearing a ruff and tights had suddenly noticed the first years. Nobody answered. "New students," said the fat friar, smiling around at them. "About to be sorted, I suppose." A few people nodded mutely. "Hope to see you in Hufflepuff," said the friar. "My old house, you know." "Move along now," said a sharp voice. "The sorting ceremony's about to start." Professor McGonagall had returned. One by one, the ghosts floated away through the opposite wall. "Now, form a line," Professor McGonagall told the first years, "and follow me." Feeling oddly as though his legs had turned to lead, Harry got into line behind a boy with sandy hair, with Ron behind him, and they walked out of the chamber, back across the hall, and through a pair of double doors into the great hall. Harry had never even imagined such a strange and splendid place. It was lit by thousands and thousands of candles, which were floating in mid-air over four long tables where the rest of the students were sitting. These tables were laid with glittering golden plates and goblets. At the top of the hall was another long table where the teachers were sitting. Professor McGonagall led the first years up here, so that they came to a halt in a line facing the other students, with the teachers behind them. The hundreds of faces staring at them looked like pale lanterns in the flickering candlelight. Dotted here and there among the students, the ghosts shone misty silver. Mainly to avoid all the staring eyes, Harry looked upwards and saw a velvety black ceiling dotted with stars.
He heard Hermione whisper, "It's bewitched to look like the sky outside. I read about it in Hogwarts, a history." It was hard to believe there was a ceiling there at all, and that the great hall didn't simply open onto the heavens. Harry quickly looked down again as Professor McGonagall silently placed a four-legged stool in front of the first years. On top of the stool, she put a pointed wizard's hat. This hat was patched and frayed and extremely dirty. Aunt Petunia wouldn't have let it in the house. Maybe they had to try and get a rabbit out of it, Harry thought wildly. That seemed the sort of thing. Noticing that everyone in the hall was now staring at the hat, he stared at it too. For a few seconds, there was complete silence. Then the hat twitched. A rip near the brim opened wide like a mouth, and the hat began to sing. "Oh, you may not think I'm pretty, but don't judge on what you see. I'll eat myself if you can find a smarter hat than me. You can keep your bowlers black, your top hats sleek and tall, for I'm the Hogwarts Sorting Hat, and I can cap them all. There's nothing hidden in your head the Sorting Hat can't see, so try me on, and I will tell you where you ought to be. You might belong in Gryffindor, where dwell the brave at heart. Their daring nerve and chivalry set Gryffindors apart. You might belong in Hufflepuff, where they are just and loyal. Those patient Hufflepuffs are true and unafraid of toil. Or yet in wise old Ravenclaw, if you've a ready mind, where those of wit and learning will always find their kind. Or perhaps in Slytherin you'll make your real friends. Those cunning folk use any means to achieve their ends. So put me on, don't be afraid, and don't get in a flap. You're in safe hands, though I have none, for I'm a thinking cap." The whole hall burst into applause as the hat finished its song. It bowed to each of the four tables and then became quite still again.
"So we've just got to try on the hat," Ron whispered to Harry. "I'll kill Fred. He was going on about wrestling a troll."
Harry smiled weakly. Yes, trying on the hat was a lot better than having to do a spell, but he did wish they could have tried it on without everyone watching. The hat seemed to be asking rather a lot. Harry didn't feel brave or quick-witted or any of it at the moment. If only the hat had mentioned a house for people who felt a bit queasy, that would have been the one for him. Professor McGonagall now stepped forward, holding a long roll of parchment.
"When I call your name, you will put on the hat and sit on the stool to be sorted," she said. "Abbot Hannah."
A pink-faced girl with blonde pigtails stumbled out of line, put on the hat, which fell right down over her eyes, and sat down. A moment's pause.
"Hufflepuff!" shouted the hat.
The table on the right cheered and clapped as Hannah went to sit down at the Hufflepuff table. Harry saw the ghost of the fat friar waving merrily at her.
"Bones, Susan!"
"Hufflepuff!" shouted the hat again, and Susan scuttled off to sit next to Hannah.
"Boot, Terry!"
"Ravenclaw!"
The table second from the left clapped this time. Several Ravenclaws stood up to shake hands with Terry as he joined them. Brocklehurst Mandy went to Ravenclaw too, but Brown Lavender became the first new Gryffindor, and the table on the far left exploded with cheers. Harry could see Ron's twin brothers catcalling. Bulstrode Millicent then became a Slytherin. Perhaps it was Harry's imagination after all he'd heard about Slytherin, but he thought they looked an unpleasant lot. He was starting to feel definitely sick now. He remembered being picked for teams during sports lessons at his old school. He had always been last to be chosen, not because he was no good, but because no one wanted Dudley to think they liked him.
"Finch Fletchley, Justin. Hufflepuff!"
Sometimes, Harry noticed, the hat shouted out the house at once, but at others it took a little while to decide. Finnegan Seamus, the sandy-haired boy next to Harry in the line, sat on the stool for almost a whole minute before the hat declared him a Gryffindor.
"Granger Hermione."
Hermione almost ran to the stool and jammed the hat eagerly on her head.
"Gryffindor!"
shouted the hat. Ron groaned. A horrible thought struck Harry, as horrible thoughts always do when you're very nervous. What if he wasn't chosen at all? What if he just sat there with the hat over his eyes for ages, until Professor McGonagall jerked it off his head and said there had obviously been a mistake and he'd better get back on the train? When Neville Longbottom, the boy who kept losing his toad, was called, he fell over on his way to the stool. The hat took a long time to decide with Neville. When it finally shouted, "Gryffindor!" Neville ran off still wearing it and had to jog back amid gales of laughter to give it to MacDougall Morag. Malfoy swaggered forward when his name was called and got his wish at once. The hat had barely touched his head when it screamed, "Slytherin!" Malfoy went to join his friends Crabbe and Goyle, looking pleased with himself. There weren't many people left now. Moon, Knott, Parkinson, then a pair of twin girls, Patil and Patil, then Perks, Sally Ann, and then, at last, Potter, Harry. As Harry stepped forward, whispers suddenly broke out like little hissing fires all over the hall. "Potter, did she say? The Harry Potter?" The last thing Harry saw before the hat dropped over his eyes was the hall full of people craning to get a good look at him. Next second he was looking at the black inside of the hat. He waited. "Hmm," said a small voice in his ear. "Difficult, very difficult. Plenty of courage, I see. Not a bad mind, either. There's talent. Oh, my goodness, yes. And a nice thirst to prove yourself. Now, that's interesting. So where shall I put you?" Harry gripped the edges of the stool and thought, "Not Slytherin, not Slytherin." "Not Slytherin, eh?" said the small voice. "Are you sure? You could be great, you know. It's all here in your head. And Slytherin will help you on the way to greatness, no doubt about that. No? Well, if you're sure, better be Gryffindor!" Harry heard the hat shout the last word to the whole hall. He took off the hat and walked shakily towards the Gryffindor table. He was so relieved to have been chosen and not put in Slytherin, he hardly noticed that he was getting the loudest cheer yet. Percy the Prefect got up and shook his hand vigorously, while the Weasley twins yelled, "We got Potter! We got Potter!" Harry sat down opposite the ghost in the rough he'd seen earlier. The ghost patted his arm, giving Harry the sudden horrible feeling he'd just plunged it into a bucket of ice-cold water. He could see the high table properly now. At the end nearest him sat Hagrid, who caught his eye and gave him the thumbs up. Harry grinned back. And there, in the centre of the high table, in a large gold chair, sat Albus Dumbledore. Harry recognised him at once from the card he'd got out of the chocolate frog on the train. Dumbledore's silver hair was the only thing in the whole hall that shone as brightly as the ghost's. Harry spotted Professor Quirrell, too, the nervous young man from the Leaky Cauldron. He was looking very peculiar in a large purple turban. And now there were only three people left to be sorted. Turpin, Lisa, became a Ravenclaw, and then it was Ron's turn. He was pale green by now. Harry crossed his fingers under the table, and a second later the hat had shouted, "Gryffindor!" Harry clapped loudly with the rest as Ron collapsed into the chair next to him. "Well done, Ron. Excellent," said Percy Weasley pompously across Harry, as Zabini Blaze was made a Slytherin. Professor McGonagall rolled up her scroll and took the sorting hat away. Harry looked down at his empty gold plate. He had only just realised how hungry he was. The pumpkin pasties seemed ages ago. Albus Dumbledore had got to his feet. He was beaming at the students, his arms opened wide, as if nothing could have pleased him more than to see them all there. "Welcome," he said. "Welcome to a new year at Hogwarts. Before we begin our banquet, I would like to say a few words."
Here they are. Nitwit, Blubber, Oddment, Tweak. Thank you. He sat back down. Everybody clapped and cheered. Harry didn't know whether to laugh or not. Is he a bit mad? He asked Percy uncertainly.
Mad, said Percy airily. He's a genius. Best wizard in the world. But he is a bit mad, yes. Potatoes, Harry.
Harry's mouth fell open. The dishes in front of him were now piled with food. He had never seen so many things he liked to eat on one table. Roast beef, roast chicken, pork chops and lamb chops, sausages, bacon and steak, boiled potatoes, roast potatoes, chips, Yorkshire pudding, peas, carrots, gravy, ketchup, and for some strange reason, mint humbugs. The Dursleys had never exactly starved Harry, but he'd never been allowed to eat as much as he liked. Dudley had always taken anything that Harry really wanted, even if it made him sick. Harry piled his plate with a bit of everything, except the humbugs, and began to eat. It was all delicious.
"That does look good," said the ghost in the rough, sadly, watching Harry cut up his steak.
"Can't you—"
"I haven't eaten for nearly 400 years," said the ghost. "I don't need to, of course, but one does miss it. I don't think I've introduced myself. Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington at your service, resident ghost of Gryffindor Tower."
"I know who you are," said Ron suddenly. "My brother's told me about you. You're nearly Headless Nick."
"I would prefer you to call me Sir Nicholas de Mimsey," the ghost began stiffly, but sandy-haired Seamus Finnegan interrupted.
"Nearly headless? How can you be nearly headless?"
Sir Nicholas looked extremely miffed, as if their little chat wasn't going at all the way he wanted.
"Like this," he said irritably. He seized his left ear and pulled. His whole head swung off his neck and fell onto his shoulder as if it was on a hinge. Someone had obviously tried to behead him, but not done it properly. Looking pleased at the stunned looks on their faces, Nearly Headless Nick flipped his head back onto his neck, coughed, and said,
"So, new Gryffindors, I hope you're going to help us win the house championship this year. Gryffindor have never gone so long without winning. Slytherin have got the cup 6 years in a row. The bloody Baron's becoming almost unbearable. He's the Slytherin ghost."
Harry looked over at the Slytherin table and saw a horrible ghost sitting there with blank, staring eyes, a gaunt face and robes stained with silver blood. He was right next to Malfoy, who, Harry was pleased to see, didn't look too pleased with the seating arrangements.
"How did he get covered in blood?" asked Seamus with great interest.
"I've never asked," said Nearly Headless Nick delicately.
When everyone had eaten as much as they could, the remains of the food faded from the plates, leaving them sparkling clean as before. A moment later, the puddings appeared. Blocks of ice cream in every flavour you could think of. Apple pies, treacle tarts, chocolate eclairs and jam doughnuts, trifles, strawberries, jelly, rice pudding. As Harry helped himself to a treacle tart, the talk turned to their families.
"I'm half and half," said Seamus. "My dad's a Muggle. Mam didn't tell him she was a witch till after they were married. Bit of a nasty shock for him."
The others laughed.
"What about you, Neville?" said Ron.
"Well, my gran brought me up, and she's a witch," said Neville. "But the family thought I was all Muggle for ages. My great-uncle Algy kept trying to catch me off my guard and force some magic out of me. He pushed me off the end of Blackpool Pier once. I nearly drowned. But nothing happened until I was 8. Great-uncle Algy came round for tea, and he was hanging me out of an upstairs window by the ankles when my great-auntie Enid offered him a meringue, and he accidentally let go. But I bounced all the way down the garden and into the road. They were all really pleased. Gran was crying, she was so happy. And you should have seen their faces when I got in here. They thought I might not be magic enough to come, you see. Great-uncle Algy was so pleased, he bought me my toad."
On Harry's other side, Percy Weasley and Hermione were talking about lessons.
"I do hope they start straight away. There's so much to learn. I'm particularly interested in transfiguration, you know, turning something into something else. Of course, it's supposed to be very difficult.
You'll be starting small, just matches into needles and that sort of thing. Harry, who was starting to feel warm and sleepy, looked up at the high table again. Hagrid was drinking deeply from his goblet. Professor McGonagall was talking to Professor Dumbledore. Professor Quirrell, in his absurd turban, was talking to a teacher with greasy black hair, a hooked nose, and sallow skin. It happened very suddenly. The hooked-nosed teacher looked past Quirrell's turban straight into Harry's eyes, and a sharp, hot pain shot across the scar on Harry's forehead. Ouch! Harry clapped a hand to his head.
What is it? Asked Percy.
Nothing.
The pain had gone as quickly as it had come. Harder to shake off was the feeling Harry had got from the teacher's look, a feeling that he didn't like Harry at all.
"Who's that teacher talking to Professor Quirrell?" he asked Percy.
"Oh, you know Quirrell already, do you? No wonder he's looking so nervous. That's Professor Snape. He teaches potions, but he doesn't want to. Everyone knows he's after Quirrell's job. Knows an awful lot about the dark arts, Snape."
Harry watched Snape for a while, but Snape didn't look at him again. At last the puddings, too, disappeared, and Professor Dumbledore got to his feet again. The hall fell silent.
Just a few more words now we are all fed and watered. I have a few start-of-term notices to give you. First years should note that the forest in the grounds is forbidden to all pupils. And a few of our older students would do well to remember that as well.
Dumbledore's twinkling eyes flashed in the direction of the Weasley twins.
I have also been asked by Mr. Filch, the caretaker, to remind you all that no magic should be used between classes in the corridors. Quidditch trials will be held in the second week of term. Anyone interested in playing for their house teams should contact Madam Hooch. And finally, I must tell you that this year the third-floor corridor on the right-hand side is out of bounds to everyone who does not wish to die a very painful death.
Harry laughed, but he was one of the few who did.
He's not serious, he muttered to Percy.
Must be, said Percy, frowning at Dumbledore. It's odd, because he usually gives us a reason why we're not allowed to go somewhere. The forest's full of dangerous beasts, everyone knows that. I do think he might have told us prefects, at least.
And now, before we go to bed, let us sing the school song, cried Dumbledore.
Harry noticed that the other teacher's smiles had become rather fixed.
Dumbledore gave his wand a little flick, as if he was trying to get a fly off the end, and a long golden ribbon flew out of it, which rose high above the tables and twisted itself snake-like into words.
"Everyone pick their favourite tune," said Dumbledore, "and off we go." And the school bellowed. "Hogwarts, Hogwarts, hoggy, warty Hogwarts, teach us something, please. Whether we be old and bald or young with scabby knees, our heads could do with filling with some interesting stuff, for now they're bare and full of air, dead flies and bits of fluff. So teach us things worth knowing. Bring back what we've forgot. Just do your best, we'll do the rest, and learn until our brains all rot."
Everybody finished the song at different times. At last, only the Weasley twins were left singing along to a very slow funeral march. Dumbledore conducted their last few lines with his wand, and when they had finished, he was one of those who clapped loudest.
"Ah, music," he said, wiping his eyes. "A magic beyond all we do here. And now, bedtime. Off you trot."
The Gryffindor first years followed Percy through the chattering crowds, out of the great hall and up the marble staircase. Harry's legs were like lead again, but only because he was so tired and full of food. He was too sleepy even to be surprised that the people in the portraits along the corridors whispered and pointed as they passed, or that twice Percy led them through doorways hidden behind sliding panels and hanging tapestries. They climbed more staircases, yawning and dragging their feet, and Harry was just wondering how much further they had to go when they came to a sudden halt.
a bundle of walking sticks was floating in mid-air ahead of them, and as Percy took a step towards them, they started throwing themselves at him. "Peeves," Percy whispered to the first years, "a poltergeist." He raised his voice.
"Peeves, show yourself."
A loud, rude sound, like the air being let out of a balloon, answered.
"Do you want me to go to the bloody Baron?"
There was a pop, and a little man with wicked dark eyes and a wide mouth appeared, floating cross-legged in the air, clutching the walking sticks.
"Oh," he said, with an evil cackle. "Ickle first is, what fun!"
He swooped suddenly at them. They all ducked.
"Go away, Peeves, or the Baron'll hear about this. I mean it," barked Percy.
Peeves stuck out his tongue and vanished, dropping the walking sticks on Neville's head. They heard him zooming away, rattling coats of armour as he passed.
"You want to watch out for Peeves," said Percy as they set off again. "The bloody Baron's the only one who can control him. He won't even listen to us prefects. Here we are."
At the very end of the corridor hung a portrait of a very fat woman in a pink silk dress.
"Password?" she said.
"Caput Draconis," said Percy,
and the portrait swung forward to reveal a round hole in the wall. They all scrambled through it, Neville needed a leg up, and found themselves in the Gryffindor common room, a cosy, round room full of squashy armchairs. Percy directed the girls through one door to their dormitory, and the boys through another. At the top of a spiral staircase, they were obviously in one of the towers, they found their beds at last. 5 four-posters hung with deep red velvet curtains. Their trunks had already been brought up. Too tired to talk much, they pulled on their pyjamas and fell into bed.
"Great food, isn't it?" Ron muttered to Harry through the hangings.
"Get off, Scabbers! He's chewing my sheets!" Harry was going to ask Ron if he'd had any of the treacle tart, but he fell asleep almost at once. Perhaps Harry had eaten a bit too much, because he had a very strange dream. He was wearing Professor Quirrell's turban, which kept talking to him, telling him he must transfer to Slytherin at once, because it was his destiny. Harry told the turban he didn't want to be in Slytherin. It got heavier and heavier. He tried to pull it off, but it tightened painfully. And there was Malfoy, laughing at him as he struggled with it. Then Malfoy turned into the hook-nosed teacher, Snape, whose laugh became high and cold. There was a burst of green light, and Harry woke, sweating and shaking. He rolled over and fell asleep again. And when he woke next day, he didn't remember the dream at all. Chapter 8 The Potions Master.
"There, look."
"Where?"
"Next to the tall kid with the red hair."
"Wearing the glasses?"
"Did you see his face? Did you see his scar?"
Whispers followed Harry from the moment he left his dormitory next day. People queuing outside classrooms stood on tiptoe to get a look at him, or doubled back to pass him in the corridors again, staring. Harry wished they wouldn't, because he was trying to concentrate on finding his way to classes. There were 142 staircases at Hogwarts, wide, sweeping ones, narrow, rickety ones, some that led somewhere different on a Friday, some with a vanishing step halfway up that you had to remember to jump. Then there were doors that wouldn't open unless you asked politely, or tickled them in exactly the right place, and doors that weren't really doors at all, but solid walls, just pretending. It was also very hard to remember where anything was, because it all seemed to move around a lot. The people in the portraits kept going to visit each other, and Harry was sure the coats of armour could walk. The ghosts didn't help either. It was always a nasty shock when one of them glided suddenly through a door you were trying to open. Nearly Headless Nick was always happy to point new Gryffindors in the right direction, but Peeves the Poltergeist was worth 2 locked doors and a trick staircase if you met him when you were late for class. He would drop waste paper baskets on your head, pull rugs from under your feet, pelt you with bits of chalk, or sneak up behind you, invisible, grab your nose and screech, "Got your conk!"
even worse than Peeves, if that was possible, was the caretaker, Argus Filch. Harry and Ron managed to get on the wrong side of him on their very first morning. Filch found them trying to force their way through a door which, unluckily, turned out to be the entrance to the out-of-bounds corridor on the third floor. He wouldn't believe they were lost, was sure they were trying to break into it on purpose, and was threatening to lock them in the dungeons when they were rescued by Professor Quirrell, who was passing. Filch owned a cat called Mrs. Norris, a scrawny, dust-coloured creature with bulging, lamp-like eyes, just like Filch's. She patrolled the corridors alone. Break a rule in front of her, put just one toe out of line, and she'd whisk off for Filch, who'd appear wheezing 2 seconds later. Filch knew the secret passageways of the school better than anyone, except perhaps the Weasley twins, and could pop up as suddenly as any of the ghosts. The students all hated him, and it was the dearest ambition of many to give Mrs. Norris a good kick. And then, once you had managed to find them, there were the lessons themselves. There was a lot more to magic, as Harry quickly found out, than waving your wand and saying a few funny words. They had to study the night skies through their telescopes every Wednesday at midnight and learn the names of different stars and the movements of the planets. 3 times a week they went out to the greenhouses behind the castle to study herbology with a dumpy little witch called Professor Sprout, where they learnt how to take care of all the strange plants and fungi and found out what they were used for. Easily the most boring lesson was History of Magic, which was the only class taught by a ghost. Professor Binns had been very old indeed when he had fallen asleep in front of the staff room fire, and got up next morning to teach, leaving his body behind him. Binns droned on and on while they scribbled down names and dates and got Emmerich the Evil and Urich the Oddball mixed up. Professor Flitwick, the charms teacher, was a tiny little wizard who had to stand on a pile of books to see over his desk. At the start of their first lesson, he took the register, and when he reached Harry's name, he gave an excited squeak and toppled out of sight. Professor McGonagall was again different. Harry had been quite right to think she wasn't a teacher to cross. Strict and clever, she gave them a talking to the moment they had sat down in her first class. "Transfiguration is some of the most complex and dangerous magic you will learn at Hogwarts," she said. "Anyone messing around in my class will leave and not come back. You have been warned." Then she changed her desk into a pig and back again. They were all very impressed and couldn't wait to get started, but soon realized they weren't going to be changing the furniture into animals for a long time. After making a lot of complicated notes, they were each given a match and started trying to turn it into a needle. By the end of the lesson, only Hermione Granger had made any difference to her match. Professor McGonagall showed the class how it had gone all silver and pointy and gave Hermione a rare smile. The class everyone had really been looking forward to was Defence Against the Dark Arts, but Quirrell's lessons turned out to be a bit of a joke. His classroom smelled strongly of garlic, which everyone said was to ward off a vampire he'd met in Romania and was afraid would be coming back to get him one of these days. His turban, he told them, had been given to him by an African prince as a thank you for getting rid of a troublesome zombie. But they weren't sure they believed this story. For one thing, when Seamus Finnegan asked eagerly to hear how Quirrell had fought off the zombie, Quirrell went pink and started talking about the weather. For another, they had noticed that a funny smell hung around the turban, and the Weasley twins insisted that it was stuffed full of garlic as well, so that Quirrell was protected wherever he went.